You can turn to Hebrews 12 as we continue in our sermon series called Supreme. And we've been talking for the last few weeks about Jesus and how he is supreme over all things, superior over all things. And last week we just covered Hebrews 11, which is this amazing passage about how there are so many people, men and women of old, who have faith because of what Jesus was able to do on the cross. And so as you turn to that passage, I want to remind us that you can also follow along with the notes on the mobile app. You can go to the App Store or Google Play Store and download it. Just search HMCC. And as we got started, I just wanted to ask us one question. Actually, two. Why is it so hard to develop endurance? As we've been talking about how Jesus is greater and we ought to have faith, there's this idea of we ought to live with faith, this joy, this exhilaration. And then the author starts talking about endurance. So why is it so hard to develop endurance in our lives? Or the converse, or the inverse of that is, why is it so easy to give up? Some of us, we struggle with physical endurance. When someone challenges us to run, we're like, no way, I can't run at all. Or some of us, it's mental endurance. When we make a decision or we commit to it, we say, hey, I'm not going to watch YouTube for this week. And then the next year, you're like, oh man, I messed up again. We give up easily. There's so many things in our lives where it's so easy to give up and to throw in the towel and just say, I quit. Maybe that's why when we see athletes compete long distance, especially marathon runners, we're really inspired because we're like, whoa, they just ran 42 kilometers. That's as much as the MTR goes from, you know, Hung Hom to my university or something like that in a span of two some hours. And there's something about these athletes who they're training and they just dedicate their whole lives to this process as they are able to accomplish some of these amazing feats of endurance. There's something inspiring about that, something that we're like, wow, I wish I could do that. Or some of us are like, no, I don't. I just would rather sit. But there's something about it that's like, you know, whoa about that. And so I wanted to show us a video about the Chicago Marathon in 2007. And I want you to look at it in the lens of endurance, because the video, it starts toward the end of the race, and the commentators focus on the two athletes who are in first and second. And I want you to focus on what the commentators are saying. The video is a little bit blurry, but you can at least make out what's happening. So just pay attention to what the commentators are saying, and then it'll give us an insight into endurance. So let's go ahead and watch this video. Wow. Whoops is right. We're like, I could never do that. I would never want to do that. I think sometimes we're laughing, right? We see that person running alongside and they catch up and we're like, whoa, you know, and it actually happens. I think the question I wanted to ask in light of that video, I was thinking, which one of the athletes would we be able to say really ran with endurance? Technically both, right? We're like, no, there's no way that we could have even finished that marathon. They completed it within a certain amount of time. So we're like, both of them finished the distance. But aside from just physical distance, which one of them would we say really ran with endurance? And I think there's something about endurance that isn't just about physical distance. It's not just about the race that we run, but it's the attitude that we run it with. And we could tell that one of the athletes' attitudes toward the end of the race was very, very different than the other's attitude, which enabled her to totally win the race at the end. And this is true for our spiritual lives, what our attitude is like, especially as we come to the end of any season or any chapter of our lives. For students, you're almost at the end of the semester, finals are coming up, and you're like, oh no, what is our attitude going to be like as we finish out the semester? For those of us who are working, there's no semester, you don't work, you know, there's no, but you have a big project coming up, or maybe it's just been a really long season of just working and it's been draining. What is our attitude like as we continue to run this race? And I wanted to talk about, and this author talks about in Hebrews 12, what it's like or how we can actually run this race with endurance and how the relationship with Christ that we have really enables us to run that race with endurance. And that's why the one thing is Jesus redefines our relationship so we can run the race with endurance. Jesus redefines our relationship so we can run the race with endurance. I want to give us two points, two things, and how and ways that Jesus redefines our relationship so that we can run with endurance. The first point is not punishment, but discipline. Not punishment, but discipline. Let's start in verse 1. Hopefully you've turned to Hebrews 12. We'll just read verse 1 just to start. It says, therefore, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us also lay aside every weight and sin which clings so closely, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us. And so here the author gives us this grand command. It says, run the race with endurance. Lay aside every weight and go run this race. And we have to see it in light of even the previous chapter, because he says, therefore. And we remember in the previous chapter, he talked about how without faith, it's impossible to please God. And he gave this whole list of all these people who ran this race with faith. And they experienced joy. They experienced some hardship, but they experienced joy and exhilaration. There's something exhilarating about running this life with faith. And he's saying, now run this race with endurance. Keep going. And that's the objective that he gives for this passage. For all the other things he talks about, now I'm going to talk about how you can run this race with endurance. And some of us are like, all right, bring it on. I'm going to do this. Other of us are like, I'm not so sure. I don't know if I can do this. But Jesus gives us two ways to help us understand how he turns punishment to discipline that allows us to run with endurance. Let's continue and read verses 2-3. It says, looking to Jesus, the founder and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is seated at the right hand of the throne of God. Consider him who endured from sinners such hostility against himself, so that you may not grow weary or faint-hearted. In your struggle against sin, you have not yet resisted to the point of shedding your blood. And the first sub-point under this is Jesus took our punishment. Jesus took our punishment. Immediately, the author asks us, look to Jesus, the founder and perfecter of our faith. The thing I wanted to kind of point out for us is in verses 2-3, the word endured is repeated twice. And he endured the cross as well as endured from sinners' hostility. He endured shame. He endured difficult things in his life that he took the punishment for. And the question that I had to ask myself was, how is it that looking at someone who endured something allows me to be encouraged to press on, to not grow weary or faint-hearted? That logical conclusion doesn't always stay whole, make sense for us. Sometimes, you know, when someone is able to do something, we get really inspired. We're like, yeah, I'm gonna, some of us, when we watch that video, like, yeah, I'm gonna run that marathon now, and I'm like, gonna beat that person who like sprinted toward the end. Most of us, I would say, like, or there's no way we can do that. And that's how often it is, right? Oftentimes when we see someone else enduring or doing something that is really admirable, oftentimes we get discouraged or we get annoyed sometimes, right? Just an example. I don't know how many of you have that friend who's like really into working out, really into exercising, and you're like, oh yeah, it'd be nice to exercise, and then they jump on that, and they're like, okay, come go exercise with me, and then you go run with them for the first time, and then the whole time you're like lagging behind them, and you're like, oh my gosh, why am I running with this person? And they're like standing next to you. They're like running next to you. They run ahead and they run back so that you can catch up with them. They're like, come on, keep going. And then you're like, OMG. I never ever want to run with this person ever, ever again. And that person running and enduring does not motivate you at all to continue to endure. If anything, it makes you more like, okay, I'm never ever going to run again. Or that you have that accountability partner, that LCG, who's that eager beaver, right? You're like, hey, I want to do better with my soap, so can you keep me accountable? And they're like, okay! And you don't know what you just asked for, because every single day they're like, hey, did you do your soap yet? Did you do your soap yet? I haven't seen your soap. Where is it? Some of you have that accountability partner. Or some of us, we ask people to help us to, you know, stay off YouTube or stay off social media. And then this is the worst thing. They're on Instagram and you're like, I'm supposed to give up Instagram. And then they send you a message through Instagram. I caught you, right? And your response in that moment is like, forget this. I'm just going to go. I'm just going to keep going through Instagram. Like, there's so many instances where when we see other people enduring or doing admirable things, it actually causes us to be more annoyed or discouraged, or we just give up, right? But then there are other examples that we take a lot more seriously when it comes to actually trying harder. We have this attitude of, oh, if we see someone enduring an example, that we want to actually apply it. We want to actually do it. We oftentimes see this when we look at the Bible, when we read the Bible, when we're in life group, we're studying this passage and we feel like, oh, we need to be more like that person. I think whenever we study the passage in David and Goliath, this happens, right? We study David and Goliath and we're like, oh man, I gotta be like David. I gotta, you know, what are my stones in my life that I can throw at this giant and then somehow conquer over all the obstacles that I go through, right? Or we read about how Jesus, you know, he fasted for 40 days. Oh man, I gotta fast too. I gotta, not 40 days, maybe just a day, maybe just a meal. But, you know, we're like, oh man, I have to live out that kind of life. Or I have to learn to love people. I have to pray. And Jesus prayed on the mountain for 40 days, you know, and how can I, you know, just pray? I gotta pray. But oftentimes when we have that kind of attitude, we try harder, and what happens the next time? We fail, we get up, give up, we get discouraged again. We miss our soap. This happens a lot, where we say, okay, I'm going to do this BRP thing, this Bible reading plan. It's now 2 years, so it's easier, and I should be able to do it. And we're like, you know, Jesus, he said the word was really important, and all my LCGs are doing it, so I got to do it too. And we set out to do it, and then every single day we're reading and reading. We're like, yeah, you know, it's going really well. And then what happens? We miss a day. And as soon as we miss a day, what happened? It's like opening that door of, it's like that Pandora's box of possibilities. As soon as you miss one day, what happens? You're like, oh, I missed one day. What's another day? I'll just make it up later. And then one day turns to 2 days, turns to 3 days. And then for some of us who are really perfectionistic, we're like, oh, I missed a whole week. I gotta finish all the previous days that I did miss before, and I have to make it up. But because we're like, oh my God, a whole week of BRP reading is like, OMG. How many chapters? 10-some chapters, 15-some chapters, no, there's no way, and we just give up, we get discouraged. And many of us, we don't realize how we turn even good Christian things into works-based things, anti-gospel things. We turn even this example of doing good things like reading our Bible or praying or loving people into something that becomes more of a human effort, a human paradigm, something that we believe that we can do in order to earn favor or be right with God. How is that any different than any other religion in the world that talks about how we have to do certain things in order to be with God? To somehow endure in this race, we have to try harder. We have to dig our knees into the ground and say, God, I'm just going to do it again. Just do it again. But when it says in verse 3, consider him who endured from sinners such hostility against himself so that you may not grow weary or faint-hearted, I want to read the next verse in the easy-to-read version. This is awesome. In verse 3 to 4, it talks about how this human paradigm is totally the wrong way of thinking about our motivation for enduring. I'll read it for us. It says, think about Jesus. He patiently endured the angry insults that sinful people were shouting at him. Think about him so that you won't get discouraged and stop trying. You are struggling against sin, but you have not had to give up your life for the cause. He says, you are struggling against sin, but you have not had to give up your life for the cause. He's saying, think about him. The way that you're able to endure and not grow weary or faint-hearted is not because Jesus did this amazing thing and you're somehow supposed to do the exact same thing he did. The point is that Jesus endured the cross because we could not. Because we were not able to. Because we weren't good enough. Because we're not faithful enough. We're not strong enough. We're not disciplined enough to do the things that Christ did. That's why he endured the cross for us on our behalf. In Isaiah 53:5, it says, but he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. Upon him was the chastisement that brought us peace, and with his wounds we are healed. We can't pay that punishment. He's saying, you did not give up your life for the cause. You didn't have to. You didn't have to die. And that's the joy and that's the motivation that we have to be able to press on to say, you know, God, it's not that bad. What I'm going through is not that hard compared to the things that you've gone through and that you suffered, that you endured. The things that I'm going through, I'm able to get through. I had this discipleship group, and I just remember just different times we were sharing as some of the brothers, we're just growing, and you know, as we're going through those times, we just had times to share openly and vulnerably, and part of that was, as we're sharing, you know, our mentors would kind of give us advice or help us to point our perspective back toward Christ, and you know, I think we got pretty good at sharing openly and vulnerably. You know, we got pretty good, and we began to share. And I remember just going around in a circle, and just in the room back in Ann Arbor, as we're in this discipleship group, we would share things like, "Yeah, man, it's been so hard. We've been struggling a lot with like anger and like, you know, not having integrity." And then we would say this phrase. Oftentimes, we would say this phrase: "I can't believe I did XYZ." And usually it would be like, "I can't believe I get angry at that person. I can't believe like I made that mistake." A lot of us were, you know, involved in ministry, so there were a lot of times where we would like either make it up ourselves or be selfish, and we'd be like, "You know, I can't believe this." And then our mentor, and as soon as we said that, I don't know, he just like caught on certain phrases. As soon as we said, "I can't believe XYZ," he'd be like, "Stop. You know, what I can't," so if we shared about like, "Oh, I can't believe I got angry at my LCG," he said, "You know, what I can't believe is that you didn't kill that person." And we're like, "What?" You know? It was like a little shocking. Like, "What do you mean? I don't want to kill that person." And we're like, why can't we believe that? Why is our perspective, why should our perspective be that? And what he was explaining was, if you think about the struggle that you're going through, to be able to understand your sin is so much greater than what you understand and what you believe in. That your capacity to struggle, your capacity to give up, your capacity to get angry is so much greater than what you see. What you can't believe, really, is that Jesus Christ gave himself in your place when you went through those things. And I think we were like, "Oh, man." We're like, "Oh, shoot." Like, you know, does that mean, you know, we can't ever say we can't believe? But we realized our mentality was, we also often compare our struggling situation. We compare our struggles, we compare our infirmities, we compare our insecurities to other people. And when we don't match up, it causes us to get discouraged. But when we compare to Jesus Christ and what he went through, everything that we go through, we realize, wow, I can be so thankful and grateful for the privilege that we have to have the relationship with God. I can't believe, God, even though I got angry, even though I fell short, God, you died for me. You took the punishment that I ought to have taken. And for us, how many of us were going through different struggles and we're experiencing things where, yeah, we can't believe it. We're like, "God, it's too hard. I'm going through this. I can't see the light at the end of the tunnel. God, I've been trying this over and over again. I've been trying to read my Bible. I just can't feel like, you know, something's happening in my faith. I don't feel like I'm growing. I'm not able to love these people. I'm not making progress in my academics or my job, my future. I'm not able to grow." But when we compare to Christ, who gave up all things, the struggles that he went through, we realize, wow, God, all the things that I'm going through really pale in comparison to what you went through. And I can be grateful, I can be thankful for the gift that you've given to me. And Jesus took our punishment. That's the first thing that we need to know. And the second, the sub-point, is Jesus gave us discipline. Let's read verses 5 to 17 together. It says, "And you have forgotten the exhortation that addresses you as sons? My son, do not regard lightly the discipline of the Lord, nor be weary when reproved by him. For the Lord disciplines the one he loves and chastises every son whom he receives. It is for discipline that you have to endure. God is treating you as sons. For what son is there whom his father does not discipline? If you are left without discipline, in which all have participated, then you are illegitimate children and not sons. Besides this, we have had earthly fathers who disciplined us, and we respected them. Shall we not much more be subject to the Father of spirits and live? For they disciplined us for a short time, as it seemed best to them. But he disciplined us for our good, that we may share in his holiness. For the moment, all discipline seems painful rather than pleasant. But later, it yields the peaceful fruit of righteousness to those who have been trained by it. Therefore, lift your drooping hands and strengthen your weak knees, and make straight paths for your feet, so that what is lame may not be put out of joint, but rather be healed. Strive for peace with everyone, and for the holiness without no one will see the Lord. See to it that no one fails to obtain the grace of God, that no root of bitterness springs up and causes trouble, and by it many become defiled. That no one is sexually immoral or unholy like Esau, who sold his birthright for a single meal. For you know that afterward, when he desired to inherit the blessing, he was rejected, for he found no chance to repent, though he sought it with tears. I want to focus on just the first half of the passage we just read in 5 through 11. In verses 5 to 6, he makes a reference to Proverbs 3:11, and he talks about how he treats us now as sons. He says, don't regard the discipline lightly. The Lord disciplines those he loves. And I wanted to give us a definition of what is the meaning of discipline. What's the definition of discipline? Strong's definition, it's from a concordance, says, discipline is education or training by implication, disciplinary correction, chastening, chastisement, instruction, or nurture. Education, training, implication, disciplinary correction, chastisement, instruction, or nurture. He redefines discipline in a way that maybe some of us, we don't think about discipline. Most of the time we think about discipline in the sense where it's something that I have to develop in order to try harder or do better. But he's turning that, or some of us think that discipline is more like punishment. When we do something wrong, we're disciplined. But he redefines and uses discipline in a way that is positive, overwhelmingly positive. He uses the definition as education or training or nurture even. And this is what the author says in this whole passage about discipline. He talks about how he disciplines the one he loves. All sons are disciplined. Those who are not disciplined are illegitimate children. I think many of us have experienced discipline personally, firsthand from our parents, whether it was a spanking or, you know, go to the corner, or some of us, we did weird disciplines, right? Some of our parents like made us squat for like hours as punishment. He talks about how discipline is a form of love, and discipline is for your good, or for our good. He totally redefines it in ways that maybe sometimes we haven't thought about it that way. In the Amplified, that verse 11, it says, for the time being, no discipline brings joy, but seems sad and painful. Yet to those who have been trained by it, afterwards, it yields the peaceful fruit of righteousness, right standing with God, and a lifestyle and attitude that seeks conformity to God's will and purpose. For that moment, in the short term, that discipline doesn't seem to feel pleasant. It doesn't bring joy. Usually it's like painful. But in the long run, for those who have been trained by it, it yields what? Righteousness, fruit of righteousness, which is what? Right standing with God. That discipline allows us to have a right standing, a right relationship with God. The question is, do we actually believe this? I just wanted to give us a proposal that oftentimes we don't believe this. As children, just as an example, children typically hate discipline. I don't think, at least children that I've encountered, when their parents are like disciplining them, they're not like, yay, you know, I'm so excited, right? Usually they cry and they weep and they're like, ah. And they hate discipline. I'm wondering, part of the reason why they hate discipline is they believe that discipline is a form of punishment. And they might believe that discipline is withholding love, right? It's like something that they wanted that they're not able to get. Or something that they didn't want that their parents are forcing them or giving them some kind of discipline or punishment. And in that mind, that child's mind, what they might be thinking is, what I want is good. So if I'm not getting what I want right now, that means this person who's disciplining me doesn't love me, doesn't care about me, doesn't value me. I had a lot of run-ins with my parents growing up, especially in eighth grade. I had all my friends, they had video game consoles. They had something called a Sega Genesis. I don't know if any of you know what that is. There's also something called a Nintendo 64, which I thought at that time was like the newest, coolest like video game console at the time. And I would just plead with my parents over and over again, like, please, you know, give me this Nintendo 64. I'll be a good kid. And yeah, I thought I would be. And then, you know, of course, my parents didn't want to give me a video game console, but I pleaded with them so much, they finally bought one for me. And then they regretted it later, right? Because after I got it, I played for days on end. I finished like the whole game within like a couple of days. And that started this whole long progression through my whole life of video game playing. It was like, yeah, the apple that of sin in my life. And through, like, that was, I think I got that first video game console when I was 8 years old. So that was when I was in primary school, and then it moved on to other games in middle school. And my parents and I, we would get into these huge fights because I would want to play video games so much. Because I was like, you know, I finished all my homework. I did all that I needed to. And I know you have to study more. I'm like, what am I supposed to study? I don't have anything to study, but you have to study more. And, you know, they really didn't want me to play video games. So what my dad would do, he traveled during the week. So on Monday before he left, he would hide all my video games. He would like store it in a cabinet, and he would lock the cabinet, and then he would fly off. And then when he came back, he would let me play on the weekends. But then of course, like being a kid, I found where he put the key, and I like opened the cabinet, and then take the video games and play it. And then of course, he would find out that I found the video game and I played it, and we would just get into these big fights. And the only thing I remember about those fights was like, you know, like, you don't love me. You're taking away my video games, like, you know, why are you doing this? And in my mind during that time, the only thing I could possibly think of is like, you, like my parents, they're just out to get me. They just don't like me, they just don't love me, and that's why they're taking away things that I enjoy, right? It's like, anything I enjoy, if there's any barrier to that, whether it's my parents, or homework, or, I don't know, sleep, or something like that, whatever that barrier is, it's like a barrier to my enjoyment. Whatever that is, it prevents me from getting the good things that I want. And so I got really frustrated by that. And we might think that that's like just a kind of a kid's kind of mindset, but how many of us, there are things that we want in our lives right now that we think are good, but we don't have it. We feel like God is withholding it from us. Aren't there some situations like that? Where we have the same mentality as a child. Where there are certain things that we want right now that we think are good for us that we're not getting. And when we don't get that thing that we want so bad, we blame God. We think God is withholding His love from us. We think God is punishing us. We think His love is not there. Some of us, we're really struggling with future right now. A lot of us, we're close to graduation or thinking about internships. Like, God, why don't I have something right now? Some of us, we've been praying this God prayer, like, God, use me. We prayed in past conferences, past retreats, we made this commitment, God, use me. I want to do all things for your glory. And you find this one opportunity. And you're like, yeah, I really believe God can use me in this one opportunity, in this one, whether it's this internship. God, I love Transformosphere, God. Use me in this internship. Or God, I really have this passion, and there's this like one project that I get to participate in. Use me for this. And for whatever reason, God's not opening any of those doors. Or maybe He has opened those doors, but you just realize you're failing in it so bad. You're not able to do it well. It wasn't what you expected it to be. And in those moments, we thank God. We get so frustrated. We get so angry. God, what are you doing in my life? God, I've been doing all these good things for you. Why is this happening to me? And automatically we think God is not there. We think God is punishing us. When, what if the very thing that God is trying to do is remove idols from our lives? What if God is saying, I'm not giving this to you right now because I know that if I gave it to you, you would take control of it yourself. You would use it for selfish purposes, selfish reasons, selfish desires. What if you got that internship and then you totally fell away because you're so in love with your future career and your success? And God knew that. And the reason why he's not giving it to you is because he knows that. Because he loves you too much to let you fall away from him. And this could be so many other situations in our lives, our careers, our academics. Why aren't we getting that 4.0? Family relationships. Why isn't my relationship with my dad better? What if God is disciplining us, wanting us to grow in our character? What if it's that relationship that we really want? We went to the DTR sermon series, the encounter. God, I did all that. I meet all the qualifications. Why doesn't she like me? We think discipline is withholding love because in our mindset, just like a child's mind, we think what we want is good right now, but we're not able to see that God is doing something different. And this is the process of maturity that we saw even in Hebrews 4, where he said, we need spiritual meat, not spiritual milk. We have to not just get the things that are just immediate or temporary, the things that will last for eternity. This was even what I went through when I first came to Hong Kong. I think I shared this story more at length before, but it just reminded me that when I first came to Hong Kong, I was doing everything for, or at least in my mind, I thought I was doing everything for God, you know? I'm like, God, I'm coming to Hong Kong. I'm like doing this church plant. I'm like a Pharisee of Pharisees, like holy and all this kind of stuff. And I'm doing everything right, God. God, I even disobeyed my parents to come here. I quit my job to come here and all that kind of stuff. And I was looking for a job while I was here and I just started to get really frustrated and really angry at God. Like, God, why aren't you providing me a job? And the one job that he was allowing me to have an interview in was too far from where we wanted to do Life Group. So I had to turn it down. And in those moments, I got so angry and so frustrated by God. I said, God, do you really love me? Do you really care? Like, the last thing I wanted to do was, like, go back to the U.S. and say, hey, Mom, Dad, I ran out of money, so I had to come back, you know? That would be the most embarrassing. I think I was too proud to be able to admit that. But in that moment, I eventually ended up finding a job right on campus at CUHK, and I just realized that job was far better than anything that I would have been able to pick out for myself. And through that whole experience, I think one of the main things that God was teaching me was that I had to learn that God was a good father, and he would give good gifts to his children. And it was so hard for me to trust in that. It was so hard for me to wait. It took 6 months from when we got to Hong Kong for me to be able to find a job. And during that time, I was just burning through cash. And like every single day, like we'd be counting coins. Like, oh, how can we? There's a in City One, there's this Octopus card, and there's something called the MTR Saver. Like you can beep your card and save $2 for the MTR fare. We do whatever possible so we can save just a couple dollars, right? Because we realize, you know, if we don't have a job or work, we would have to go back eventually. And I realized during that period of time, I was so frustrated during it. But when I realized I came out of it at the end, I realized, wow, God really was disciplining me to help me to trust in him, to help me to grow in my character, to help me to know that God is trustworthy. He is a good father for me. So I'm just wondering for us, what are some of the struggles that we go through, that we're struggling with, that we feel like, God, where are you in this situation? What if we had this perspective in every single one of our struggles and trials? Every single time we felt like God was punishing us, we thought, maybe, God is disciplining us, not because he doesn't like us, but because he loves us as his children. Because he cares for us too much. He wants us to experience the peace, the fruit of righteousness in our lives, this connection with God so much. That he's not willing to let us go down our own paths. And the author concludes with verses 12 to 17. I won't read it again, but just summarizing it, verses 12 to 13 is just encouraging us now as we recognize that we don't have punishment, but we have discipline. We can then strengthen our drooping hands or our weak knees. We can, all verses 13 to 14 to 15 to 17 is all about loving others, caring for others, thinking about others. And the way that we can really run endurance, when we realize, God, I'm going through these things, I'm recognizing that you're doing it because you love me so much. Not because you hate me, but because you're wanting to restore this relationship with me. Now, my way of then to run it with endurance is then to go love someone else. Is not to just sulk and to be like, God, I know it's so hard, but it's so hard. And then oftentimes we just go into a corner and we get self-focused and we just have this like, oh, kind of, you know, facial expression and we can't think outside of ourselves. But God is saying, then the response that we have is to think outwardly, to think outside of ourselves, to love others, to love God and to love people. And so if we understand that we have this new relationship with Him, not punishment, but discipline, it will help us to run the race with endurance. And that was the first point. And the second point is not only not punishment, but discipline, but the other way that He changes and redefines our relationship with Him is not fear, but awe. Doesn't give us fear, but awe. Let's read verses 18 to 24 as we continue. It says, "For you have not come to what may be touched, a blazing fire and darkness and gloom and a tempest, the sound of trumpet and a voice whose words made the hearers beg that no further messages be spoken to them. For they could not endure the order that was given. If even a beast touches the mountains, it shall be stoned. Indeed, so terrifying was the sight that Moses said, I tremble with fear. But you have come to Mount Zion and to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, to innumerable angels in the festal gathering, and to the assembly of the firstborn who are enrolled in heaven, and to God, the judge of all, and to the spirits of the righteous made perfect, and to Jesus, the meditator, the mediator of a new covenant, and to the sprinkled blood that speaks a better word than the blood of Abel." And here we see the author is now making this whole description, and he compares and contrasts two different mountains in the Bible. The first mountain is Mount Sinai. So in verses 18 to 21, he's describing the Mount Sinai, which was the mountain when the Israelites came out of Egypt. The first stop that they went through after they passed the Red Sea was to make a covenant with God. And he did that. He asked Moses to climb up this mountain, and it was this like fiery mountain where the Israelites could not approach, because God was too holy. And as Moses went up, he gave them the Ten Commandments and said, you have to obey these laws. This is the covenant that I give to you so that I can be with you. And then the second mountain over here on this side is Mount Zion. And he talks about this in the prophecies. He talks about this in Revelation, where it's this new mountain of God that comes down and allows us to be with Him. And he describes it here in so many ways. And I wanted just to compare Mount Sinai versus Mount Zion, where in the old we see words like being stoned, death. Whereas in the new, there's this idea of living, of joy. In the old, there was this gloom, this darkness, this tempest. And in the new, there's this festival or this joyful gathering with angels singing. In the old, we couldn't come to God. And in the new, he says, we have come to God. I just wanted to point out that the old relationship was largely defined by fear. The old relationship that Israelites went through was largely defined by fear. And when we recognize that a relationship is defined by fear, fear causes us to do a lot of weird things. It causes us, it controls us in many ways. And sometimes we have irrational fears or weird fears. And personally, I have some irrational or weird fears myself. I wanted to show you some of them. And some of you may identify with that if you do. I'll give you a pound it. When I came to Hong Kong, I was like, wow, I've never seen lifts or elevators as fast as Hong Kong. And in my personal flat, or my personal tower, the fastest elevator I've ever been in. The doors close like immediately as soon as you press the button. They close so hard that they hit you. And then it's not until they hit you twice that they open back up. It's like really scary. And so one fear I have is the fear of the cable breaking in the elevator. So I don't know if you've ever been in those elevators where your friend thinks it's a really good idea to like jump in the elevator just to freak you out. You're like, oh my God. And then your response, or my response is like to run to the corner of the elevator. As if the corner somehow is safer than the center of the elevator. Right? We do weird things when we get afraid. The next one, this is not my personal fear, but some of us are afraid of birds. Some of you can't even look, right? But the thing is, this is just a picture of a bird. Some of you are like, oh. Right? Fear makes us do weird things. This bird is not going to hurt you. Don't worry. The next one, I don't know how many of you grew up sleeping in a bunk bed. I had a fear of falling off the bunk bed. I've heard stories of people who slept on the top bunk and woke up on the floor because they fell off, and they don't know when they fell off. They didn't even wake up, but they just fell off. It's very interesting. Another fear is falling down the middle of a spiral staircase. Have you ever felt that? And then I have friends who, when they see that, they kind of like walk along the wall and just try to go down as if that there's this mysterious force that's going to push them over the railing. Some of us are terrified of bridges collapsing, right? There's actually a bridge out there. I don't know if you know, but if people run across that bridge, it shakes a little bit. You should try it out. It's really fun. But I don't know if you know, just a side comment, bridges are designed to shake. Because if they're not designed to shake, then they'll crumble and they'll actually break. So actually the shaking is designed to help the bridge stay intact. So don't fear, don't worry. If the bridge is wobbling a little bit, it's good for you. There's another place, as I walk down to my office every single day, I have to walk over these grates. Something, I don't know, I'm a little OCD, but whenever I'm walking over these grates, I'm like kind of like tiptoeing because I'm afraid I'm going to fall in. Like these things, there's this irrational fear. So sometimes I like kind of walk around it because I'm afraid that I'm going to fall through. And then I don't know how many of you have actually driven around. I don't think it's as common in Hong Kong, but maybe in China or in the U.S. There are these trucks. It says flammable gas. And you're like, oh no. Even though it says non-flammable gas on the other side, right? Like, what happens? Like, you, like, slowly drift farther and farther away from that car to stay as far as possible, just in case it will explode for some reason. And then the last one, before you show it, this is the one that all millennials are terrified of. It's no mobile phone signal, right? And then what happens? You get withdrawal symptoms, you're like, oh my God, like, I can't do anything now. My fear creates weird or interesting situations, and whether we like to admit it or not, it controls us in more ways than we think it does. In some funny ways and in some deeper ways, too. And I'm wondering how many of us, we're still controlled by fear in different areas of our lives. Different areas of our lives, whether it's fear of people. People could be a range of people. Some of us, we're afraid of our family members, different conflicts that we're going through. Some of us, we have fear of what authority is going to think of us. Older people that have ability to give us criticism or feedback. Some of us are really afraid of what our peers are going to think of us because we really want to be in the in crowd. We're afraid of rejection. Other of us, we're fearing failure. We're afraid of our performance. We're not good enough. And the list goes on of different things that we are afraid of. And what does this fear do to us? It leads to anxiety. It leads us to do things that we'll regret later on. We'll compromise. Some of us, we're so afraid. You know, we're here in Hong Kong, just by God's grace, on scholarship for some of us. And we're so afraid, God, if I'm not able to get this GPA, I'm gonna ruin my family. I'm gonna forfeit my tuition here. I'm not gonna be able to study. And because I'm so afraid, I can't go to life group. I can't meet with my LCG, I have to skip it. I can't even do my BRP because I'm like so stressed out and anxious during this final season. Some of us, when we're working, we're so afraid of what that evaluation that we're gonna get from our supervisor. And so anytime, even if it's off work hours, as soon as we get a message, we're like, oh man, I have to take care of this. Even if it's like right, we're right in the middle of like having LCG, or we're at Sunday celebration, we're working, or we're worshiping. Even if we don't have to get to it right in that moment, There's some fear that comes over us that says, like, oh, if I don't respond right away, or if I don't fix this right now, then yeah, my boss is not going to give me a good evaluation. I'm not going to be able to get that bonus that I wanted. I'm not going to get that raise. And we get paralyzed. We do things that in our normal everyday lives we would never want to do, or we would never want others to do to us. And this is the fear, and this is the old way that the Israelites lived in. But this is not the way that Christ imagined us to continue living in. I want to read from two verses in 2 Timothy 1:7. It says, "For God gave us a spirit not of fear, but of power and love and self-control." Not of fear, but of power, love, and self-control. When we're afraid, we have no self-control. We're controlled by something else. We're controlled by whatever it is that we fear. And what we say oftentimes in our church is, what we fear is what we worship. If we fear our grades, we're going to be controlled by that assignment, by that exam. If we fear our relationships, we're going to be controlled by those people, what they think of us. If we fear our performance, we're going to be controlled by our work, by our accomplishments. And in 1 John 4:18, it says, "There's no fear in love, but perfect love casts out fear. For fear has to do with punishment, and whoever fears has not been perfected in love." This is the antidote to our fear, is knowing that there is a God who loves us, knowing that there is a God who gave himself for us. This new relationship that we have, the old one was defined by fear. This new relationship we have is defined by awe. It's defined by awe. When we go back and read through that, verses 22 to 24, there's just so many descriptions of this awe. Now, oftentimes we only focus on love, like, oh, Jesus died for you, he loves you, he cares for you, and you should be good. There's no more fear, right? And he cares for you as like a little lamb, and you can rest in him. We love that psalm, right, where he says, like, come to me, or what does he say? I forgot. Something by streams of living water, right? Sorry, I totally forgot. But in this passage, he gives these descriptions, not just of this individual love, but this new mountain that we go to, this new community, this new life that we're able to enter into. That's not just about this individual love, but this awe that we have. He talks about countless thousands of angels and joyful gathering, an assembly of God's firstborn children. We have a new community. That's why we believe in life group. Because it's not a community based on your performance, based on your works, based on your personality, based on your ability. Some of us are like, thank God, it's not based on any of those things. I am accepted. We have this new community that we're able to be accepted and cherished by. In that verse, it talks about how we can come to God. We come to Jesus himself. We have a new relationship. We have a new relationship with God that anytime we want to, we can talk with him. We can converse with him. He's our comforter. So the Holy Spirit has been given to us as our counselor, as our guide. In the New Living Translation, it talks about how at the end, we have forgiveness instead of vengeance. There's so many things that we did previously. We are forgiven of that. We don't have to be punished for it. We have new life, new hope, new purpose. And it's this awe, this reverence. Not just this individualized love, and not this other side, this fear of like God is so great and so unapproachable that we're able to have this awe of who God is. I want to read this quote from Brennan Manning. I think he encapsulates this really well. He's the person who wrote the Ragamuffin Gospel. He says, "I want neither a terrorist spirituality," he uses really strong words there for what we want to avoid, "neither a terrorist spirituality that keeps me in a perpetual state of fright about being in right relationship with my Heavenly Father, nor a sappy spirituality that portrays God as such a benign teddy bear that there's no aberrant behavior or desire of mine that he will not condone." Aberrant behavior is like disobedience. "I want a relationship with the Abba of Jesus, who is infinitely compassionate with my brokenness and at the same time an awesome, incomprehensible, and unwieldy mystery." When was the last time that we saw God this way? that not only was God someone who came to us as a loving Father, who met us in our deepest, darkest difficulties, but at the same time, He's this awesome and amazing God who has done all things. He created the heavens. He could do anything at any time He wants. And we approach Him saying, God, wow, You are amazing. You're awesome. You are powerful. And at the same time, You're on my side. And that somehow that gives us the sense of awe, the sense of amazement that, wow, I serve this kind of God. There's something about running that just helps me to kind of see this awe. I really enjoy running late at night along the river, and I think it's just an opportunity for me just to kind of get things off my chest and pray, especially when I'm anxious. And I think just kind of a personal, honest confession, this whole week I was preparing for this message, and I think I started to get really anxious. I started to get very fearful. You know, I think I think one thing that I personally struggle with a lot is wondering how well I'm going to do. My fears and how I perform or how well I will do or what people will think of me. So I was really worried, like, oh man, this message has to be perfect. It has to be great. I have to have like the best funny illustrations. I have to crack the right jokes at the right time. The worst part is no one laughs at the jokes that I intend to make, but then, you know, the weird times that I'm not intending to make jokes. And so I was preparing for this message, and on Thursday night, I was like, God, like, I just couldn't think of any kind of illustration. I couldn't think of anything to help, you know, kind of help me understand this point for myself and to be able to communicate it. And I was like, okay, I'm just going to go for a run. So I was running, and the whole time I was running, like, I was just getting frustrated. I was just like, God, like, I'm praying and I'm running and I'm just trying to like get something, but I just feel like I can't. And the more I wasn't able to think of something, the more anxious I got, the more fearful I got. And then, like, my heart started pounding. I mean, it was pounding because I was running, but I think it was pounding more because of my anxiety, right? So it's like really weird. Like, you're pounding because you're running, but then you were getting anxious at the same time. It's like pounding extra. It's like really bad feeling. And so it was just pounding, and I was like realizing, oh man, like, I'm getting more and more anxious. I'm getting more and more fearful. And it brought me back to even the first couple of times that I preached. And I just remember the whole week just leading up to it, I was just really anxious because I was constantly thinking, like, what is that person going to think of me? How am I going to be evaluated? Like, what if? And then my mind would go make these connections down, like, this deep, dark path that is never good. So I would, oh, what if the sermon doesn't go well? And then what if I get feedback where, like, I can't preach anymore, and then I can't be this pastoral intern anymore, and then I get kicked out, and I go back to the U.S., like, all this kind of stuff, right? Like, it just starts making those connections. And then, as I was running, I was thinking back to that moment, and I remember the first two times I was preaching, for whatever reason, I just, like, when I was taking the MTR down to Hong Hong before I was preaching, I started reading the BRP. Like, I never read the BRP before Sunday celebration, except for before I preach. It's like really interesting, and I read it this morning, by the way. And it was, as I was reading, I remember those two times, for whatever reason, that reading that morning just really spoke to me. It exposed my heart of people-pleasing. It exposed how I was fearful of what man thought instead of what God thought. And after I was finished reading, I sent my soap out to my LCGs and other people I keep accountable with. Like, I just had peace. I mean, I was still nervous for the message, but I think when I was able to share, there's this overwhelming sense of, God, I'm not doing this to earn the approval of man. I'm preaching to You, God, and I'm preaching to myself because this is something that I need, and this is something I'm doing because of my relationship with You, not to earn people's approval. And I just remember, like, after those messages, like, I was so thankful and I was so joyful. And I was just in awe of God and who He was. And so fast forward back to this past Thursday, I was thinking about those times and I was, like, remembering, like, wow, God, You've been so faithful in my life. And when I look back on all the times that I've been able to preach and all the ways that God has been working in my life, I just began to have this sense of awe of God. Like, God, not only do You love me, but You're so strong and powerful that You're able to change my heart. You're able to work through my life to help me to overcome the fears and the anxieties and insecurities that I have. And it was really amazing. I don't know if any of you have had this thing called runner's high, where you start running And then it's really cool. I was watching videos on running last night, just to kind of know more about running. But it was like at a certain point, like your mind starts releasing these like endorphins or these chemicals that like as you're running, you just start to enjoy it. And it doesn't feel like running anymore. It just feels like you're flying almost, and you just enjoy running. And as I was thinking about just, wow, God, you're so good, I just began, you know, almost sprinting to the last leg of that run that I had. And at the end, I was just like, you know, just like very epic. I was like imagining like epic music in my mind. I was like, God, I'm running for you, you know, like in my mind, it was really epic, but it was kind of corny. But at the same time, I think that run, as I came to the end, I was like, wow, God, you're right. I don't have to fear anymore. I don't live in that old relationship that I used to. I now have this new relationship where not only you love me individually, but you are such a great and amazing God that you can overcome all things. And you're so holy that sometimes it's frightening, but at the same time, you're working on my life, and I can see that. And I can step forward in faith, overcoming the fears and insecurities I have, because you're with me. And the question is, how about us? How many of us, we still live in fear? That there's so many situations in our lives that we feel like we can't overcome. God, it's too hard. It's too difficult. Even reading the Bible, even praying, I can't get over it. I can't seem to work things out. Right now, today, like, God, I'm so frustrated. Like, this happened, and I can't get out of this right now. When maybe God is saying, hey, look at all the things that I've done. And look at the new relationship that I've given to you. And be in awe of who I am. That you now have a new relationship. You have a new community. You have new life. You have all these things. Sometimes we just need to look back and see with perspective all the things that God has done in our lives. And when we see that trajectory, we realize God has actually been doing amazing things in our lives. And just in that moment, we just need to sit and just be like, God, wow, I'm amazed at you. I'm amazed at how faithful you've been to me. And no longer do I have to fear people or circumstances or performance, but I can fear you and be in awe of you more than anyone else. Let's finish with verses 25 to 29. So see that you do not refuse him who is speaking. For if they did not escape when they refused him who warned them on the earth, much less will we escape if we reject him who warns from heaven. At that time, his voice shook the earth, but now he has promised, yet once more I will shake not only the earth, but also the heavens. And this phrase, yet once more, indicates the removal of things that are shaken. That is, things that have been made in order that the things that cannot be shaken may remain. Therefore, let us be grateful for receiving a kingdom that cannot be shaken. And thus let us offer to God acceptable worship with reverence and awe, for our God is a consuming fire. The main thing I want to highlight from this passage is how the author talks about this idea of shaking. In verse 26, it says that his voice shook the earth. And then yet, once more, I will not only shake the earth, but the heavens, and that in order that the things that cannot be shaken may remain in verse 27 and verse 28, let's be grateful for receiving a kingdom that cannot be shaken. And he repeats this over and over and over again. And essentially what he's saying is that there's so many things in our lives that when we really look at it, they're going to be temporary. They're going to be shaken. That job that you have, that relationship, that prize, that grade, that GPA, it's all temporary. But there is something that we have that is unshakable. And it's not like something that we have to get. I think sometimes we think that, oh, we have to go get this thing. But what does he say? He says, let us be grateful for receiving a kingdom. That means we've already received it. We already have it. And what is that thing that is unshakable that we have? It's our relationship with Christ. It's that relationship that he redefines for us. In Revelation 21, this is a little bit longer passage, but I want to read it for us, 1-7. And the New Living Translation. Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the old heaven, the old earth had disappeared. And the sea was also gone. And I saw the holy city, the New Jerusalem, coming down from God out of heaven like a bride, beautifully dressed for her husband. I heard a loud shout from the throne saying, look, God's home is now among his people. He will live with them and they will be his people. God himself will be with them. He will wipe away every tear from their eyes and there will be no more death or sorrow or crying or pain. All these things are gone forever. And the one sitting on the throne said, look, I am making everything new. And he said to me, write this down, for what I tell you is trustworthy and true. And he also said, it is finished. I am the Alpha and Omega, the beginning and the end. To all who are thirsty, I will give freely from the springs of the water of life. All who are victorious will inherit all these blessings, and I will be their God, and they will be my children. This is the relationship that we inherit. This is the gospel. When he says it is finished, it reminds us of when Jesus Christ said it is finished on the cross. And when he said it is finished, it meant everything, every struggle and every difficulty that we've gone through. Every time that we've given up. Every hardship, every broken relationship. Every moment we said, God, I cannot push through. Every time we said, God, it's too hard, it's too painful. He said, it is finished. Because you have this relationship with me, that you can look forward to this day where there's going to be no more tears, no more pain, no more sorrow. He redefines that relationship, that we no longer have this punishment. We have this discipline, for he loves us as his sons and daughters. And we no longer have fear, but we have this awe of who God is and what he did. And this is who our God is. The fact that he has done this, he died on the cross for us, and as he rose from the grave, we now can celebrate. And we can endure because we're looking forward to this greater future, this heaven, this relationship with him that no one can take from us. It's unshakable. And we can say, God, because I'm looking forward to this, I can lay aside every weight, every struggle, every pain. I acknowledge that it's there, but I'm not going to be defined by it. I'm not going to be hindered by it. I'm not going to stop because of it. But I can run the race with endurance because you've given this relationship to me that I know is unshakable. And no one, nothing can separate me from the love of God that is in Christ Jesus. And that's why the one thing is Jesus redefines our relationship so that we can run the race with endurance. Jesus redefines our relationship so we can run the race with endurance. I want to give us some next steps before we close. First one is reassess your relationship with Jesus. Reassess your relationship with Jesus. I don't know if maybe some of us, we can really identify with that fear of punishment. We can identify with the struggles, or we felt like maybe we're that child where there's something that we want and we didn't get. And because of that, we feel like God is punishing us, or we feel like God's love isn't there. We need to reevaluate, is our relationship with God based on performance, based on our circumstances, based on all these worldly, temporal things, or is it based on the truth of who he is and what he's done, how he redefined our relationship for us? I would just encourage us to spend some time reflecting, just journal a little bit. Spend some time saying, God, how do I see you? Do I see you as a loving father? Do I see you as like a master, a brutal master, and I'm your slave or I'm your servant? Do I see you as my boss rather than my friend and a comforter? The second thing is run the race with endurance. And I shared this as just as a broad kind of application because there are many different ways that we can run. I don't know what that is for all of us, but maybe God wants us to say, you know, you need to persevere through this project that you're working on. Maybe you have groupmates that are really, really difficult to love and to care for. You need to love well. You need to follow through. Now, as you realize how God has redefined our relationship, my relationship, I'm able to love my groupmates. I'm able to care for them. I'm able to do my part. Whatever it might be, for you to be able to run the race, to finish well, to endure to the end. And then lastly is rejoice as we look toward Easter. I think we can't talk about running toward endurance unless we talk about that one moment or that one day, that one significant event that allows us to look forward to this heavenly hope that we have. And like we've mentioned a couple times before, we only have 2 weeks till Easter has come up. And I wonder how many of us we've relished and we've rejoiced at knowing that on Easter Sunday, Jesus Christ rose again from the grave. And as he rose again, he made us co-heirs with Christ. He rose us with him. And because of that, we have all the blessings that he has given to Christ. And we can take hold of that. And that allows us to run with endurance. And it allows us to also rejoice and to invite other people to say, you know, God, as I've enjoyed and as I've experienced you and as I've so thankfully just been blessed by you, how can I then rejoice and invite someone else to join us on Easter to celebrate who God is so they can experience him as well? As we close, I just wanted to leave us with this video. It's about a runner at the Olympics who something happens. And oftentimes when we fall, when we go through trials, we go through difficulties, those are the times that we get most discouraged. But those are the times that we have to endure the most. Those are the times that we need to go back to our relationship with God and say, God, because of who you are and this relationship that you have with me, I can get back up again. And I can run as hard as I can to the finish line because of what you've done in my life. And my hope and my prayer is that all of us, we can say the same thing that Paul did in 2 Timothy 4:7. He says, I have fought the good fight. I have finished the race. I have kept the faith. Let's do that. Let's say, God, because of what you've done in my life, because of the relationship I have with you, I want to run. I want to run as hard as I can, as far as I can, as much as I can to the end. So let's watch this video together and we'll close out. Can we stand as we close? We might not be athletes in the Olympic Games. I think all of us, we can identify with some kind of fall, some kind of hurt, some kind of pain. And we're not sure why it's there. We might blame God. We might ask, why is this happening to me? And the pain seems too great to be able to continue. Too difficult to carry on. But there's something about getting back up, finishing the race, running with endurance. For this athlete, it was just the desire to finish. Because her hope was this Olympic dream and being able to just say that she did it. For us, it's this chorus of heavenly angels, this hope that we have. This cloud of witnesses that are cheering us on. It says, get back up. Yes, it's painful. Yes, it's difficult. Yes, it's tiring. But it's worth it. But it's worth it. And maybe for some of us, God is compelling us to get back up. I don't know what that pain or that struggle might be going through. It might be something really, really deep and really difficult. And we're like, God, I don't know how you could ever help me to overcome, help me to push through. Saying, look at the cross. Look at how I gave my life for you. Look at the new hope, the new heaven, the new earth that I have prepared for you, that you can run with
with endurance. Can we just pray and just confess that to God? I think God can handle it. He can hear our venting sometimes. Sometimes we just need to say, God, where were you? Why is this happening to me? We might need to just say, it's too hard right now. And let God encourage us as we remember all the things that He has done. This redefined relationship that He gives to us, that can give us hope, that can give us joy, that can allow us to endure. So can we just take a few moments? Let's just begin to pray and just confess that to God. Whatever situation you might be in, whatever hurt, whatever difficulty, just begin to pray and just say, God, help me to think through this. Help me to endure. Help me to run this race. Just loud enough so you can hear yourself. Just begin to pray through that. We'll go into some time.